This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello, my name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life. Today, we're speaking with Delcy, a 32-year-old who has been nominated as LGBTIQ Person of the Year, and who is also known for running unicorn events, which bring together members of the LGBTIQ community in a fun and supportive atmosphere. Additionally, Delcy works with LGBTIQ youth, and she was recently the winner of a defamation lawsuit, one of the first of its kind for an LGBTIQ person in Australia. In the second half of our show, we'll speak with Bruce, who works in an outpatient program at a drug and alcohol center. Bruce was also one of the first people to be diagnosed with HIV in Queensland, Australia. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
Okay, my name's Delcy. I'm 33 years old. I use she, her pronouns and identify as a queer femme bisexual woman. For the last 10 or so years, I've been really focused on creating safer and inclusive LGBTQIA+ spaces. So spaces for adults and young people and to celebrate their sexuality and their gender identity. But outside of my work, I'm just like a super girly girl who likes like eco glitter and the colour pink, and I have a cat called Peppy Muffin, and I live in a rainbow apartment, and just living like my best pink life. Pink is like, obviously I really appreciate the aesthetic, I think it's a beautiful colour, but for me it's about embracing femininity. And I know when I was coming out as a raging queero, I didn't really have much representation of queer femme people where I was. Like, I grew up in Canberra, and if I knew a woman who identified as gay, they pretty much never were femme. And I found that kind of something that was hard for me to grapple with in my own identity, of realizing that I could be queer and femme at the same time. Like, I went through that whole process of trying to look gay. And for me, that meant like cutting my hair off and wearing a flannelette. So it's actually been a bit of a journey for me to go, hey, it's okay to be queer and same-sex attracted and be feminine. So I think now I really like to push the femininity to the extreme, because I'm like really femme proud. I often imagine that I'm still going to be running unicorn parties when I'm like 70, running around, you know, semi-clothed in pink sparkles, covered in glitter, long pink hair extension hair. I don't think I'm going to change anytime soon. Like, I feel like I dress like a 15-year-old, even though I'm, you know, in my 30s. I get a lot of like, yeah, my clothing choices resemble like a high school student or something, but that's totally fine. And when I go and sell my clothes at the Fitzroy markets, like, my main clientele seem to be quite young girls. So I think my aesthetic is quite similar to what they would be into, unicorns and ponies and glitter. I think I am good at my job, and I'm really responsible in that, and I'm a good leader. At times, but I think I also definitely have like a really playful, youthful side as well. And I've worked a lot with young people, so I'm on their level. Like, I was a high school teacher, so I definitely know how to connect with, and I really enjoy talking to young people. But also can be like a boss lady, you know, when I'm running around my events being the boss. Yeah, I'm hugely passionate about supporting queer young people and helping them create safe, fun spaces. And I think for a lot of us, we think about the time when we were, say, in high school and we didn't have that opportunity. I know growing up in Canberra, there was no queer group. There was no, you know, safe schools group. There was no place to go as a queer person and connect with other people. So I think for a lot of us adults, we look at that and go, wouldn't that have been really beneficial to know, one, that you could be queer and that being queer was okay, but also that it was celebrated? Like, how special is that? And one of the projects I'm working on at the moment for Minus 18 is organising their queer formal in Adelaide. And that's something I'm hugely passionate about, because a lot of people who identify as LGBTQIA+ struggle when it comes to going to their school formal or prom or whatever it's called, because, you know, they can't or they don't feel comfortable going in the clothes that, you know, align with their gender identity, or they don't feel like they can take, you know, the partner of the gender they would like. So creating opportunities where students can have access to the things that, you know, non-queer students have access to, but also, you know, be told that you're amazing and be celebrated and have that night of freedom, I think is so important. But I think, yeah, we really need nice, fun spaces to remind ourselves why it's amazing to be queer, and sometimes to escape the other parts of our lives which maybe are a little bit more difficult.
When you were growing up in Canberra, were you out when you were in high school and middle school?
No, not at all. And to be honest, I didn't really even understand that I could be queer. I remember being really attracted to this girl in year 9 who was really good at sport, but I thought my brain was confused. I remember thinking, your brain is just like a little bit confused, because I thought I was flirting with her, but I wasn't sure what I was doing. But I, it sounds bizarre, but I didn't know you could be a girl and be same-sex attracted, because I knew there were gay men in Canberra, but I never met a gay woman. So I just had no idea, until I moved to Sydney, actually. And suddenly I was running events and, I was running music festivals and all my friends were lesbians and I thought I was like their token straight friend. But it's that classic case of, you know, hanging out in queer scenes, thinking you're not queer, and then suddenly being like, oh, I'm not just a really good ally, I am queer.
So you grew up in Canberra. What was that like?
A little bit grey, but you don't know anything different, do you? Yeah, I think it's a nice place to grow up because it's quiet and it's calm, but I always felt like I didn't belong. I won an award in high school for being what was called the biggest Gumby, which I think meant that you just didn't fit in and people thought you were a bit silly, but I think that's how people saw me. But I never really felt like I was comfortable. And people always said, you will leave Canberra. And I was like, oh, okay. And then eventually I did. But when I go back there, I do think it's a nice place. And I think it's a pretty bad rap. Every time I say I'm from Canberra, I get the classic kind of insults. But I do think it is a nice place. But didn't have the opportunities or the community that I definitely was searching for.
What are the classic insults?
Politics, they're like, do you run into politicians all the time? That kind of thing. You have lots of roundabouts in Canberra is another classic one.
These are really bad.
It's what Canberra is known for, politicians and roundabouts.
What are your parents like? Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got 2 siblings, an older brother who lives in Japan. He moved there when he was about 18 and he'd be now 35. And then my younger brother still is in Canberra. He really likes it there. I think it suits him, so he stayed put. And my parents are there, retired, living their brilliant retired life, just traveling and having a nice time.
What did your parents notice that you were a bit of an outsider when you were growing up?
Probably. Yeah, I think so. I don't think they understood why. Like, no, I don't think anyone ever predicted I was going to be queer. And when I came out, they were definitely surprised. And I had the classic, oh, but you wear dresses and you're really girly. How can you be gay? A bit of confusion around that. But I think I was like a drama kid and a film kid. So I think they just assumed I was like that, you know, a little bit of that quirky, arty type rather than a queero. But yeah, they were definitely surprised when I came out to them via an email when I was in my early 20s.
An email. Why an email?
I just thought it was like a safe way to go about it. Like, they'll have time to process it. They can think about it before they need to talk to me. Yeah, my mum's a social worker, so I thought that would be something that would work for her, just having time to think about it before we spoke about it. But I wrote this real casual email. I had my first girlfriend, and I remember writing to her just being like, hey, hope things are good. Just letting you know I have a girlfriend, but don't worry, I still like boys. yeah, I didn't hear from her for a while after that. We've come a long way. So that would have been 8 or 10 years ago, I think. And yeah, I feel like it was definitely uncomfortable for them, initially. And there was a lot of work to have been done and we had a lot of, you know, hardish conversations, but we're now at a really good point and to the point where my mum actually comes to my events. She'll come to Unicorns. She came to Unicorns Mardi Gras last year, and she was there from like set up to pack down. Yeah, she loves it. She loves being a part of it. She loves saying she's Unicorn, the Unicorn Mum. She'll wear a name tag that says Unicorn Mum. So yeah, Unicorns is all about celebrating all aspects of queerness. It's a mixture of music and performance art and activities, but it's all about celebrating all it means to be queer. And yeah, I started in Sydney because I felt like there were definitely lesbian spaces and, you know, there were gay guy spaces, but there weren't really spaces for the rest of the community. So if you know trans or non-binary, or even if you were a queer person who had access needs, I felt like it wasn't really being catered for. So the big focus of why I created it was I wanted to be for all those people that, you know, at that time we just didn't have spaces. And I wanted to be able to have all members of the community together, because my friendship group was really diverse, but there weren't a space we could go all together, which sounds really simplistic, but it just wasn't around. So that's why it started. And yeah, it started in Sydney and is now across Sydney and Melbourne. But yeah, it turns out there was quite a lot of people like me who felt like they didn't have places to go. Like I felt like I couldn't be out as bisexual in a lesbian space. And yeah, turns out lots of other people felt like that too, because it's grown. I probably put too much thought into it, and I don't know if it sounds a bit arrogant, but I feel like it's more than a party. Like, I feel like it's community, it feels like home, it feels like safety, it feels like inclusion, it feels like being prioritized. And it's not just like a space with a DJ, like there's so many things going on. So there'll be cute activities where you can get body painted or eco-glittered, or if the theme is all about dressing as a cat, there's like a catty workshop. The next one I'm going to have like love letters where you can write love letters to other people in the space. One time I had an award ceremony where if someone had done something lovely throughout the year, you write it down on a note and then I'd read them out on stage. So a lot of really unusual random things happen that you wouldn't necessarily get at a typical warehouse party. I got everyone, like 500 queer people, to be quiet at midnight so I could read out beautiful things that people had done for other people throughout the year and then crowned these people on stage. So yeah, it is a party, but I feel like it's, yeah, it's more than a party at the same time.
So your mom's a social worker. What does your dad do?
He worked in the typical Canberra job of being a public servant in the Department of Transportation. I think he consulted on things like the tram that they've just installed that everyone in Canberra is really excited about. But yeah, very responsible human. Worked in that job for a long time, but now also enjoying retired life. Finally learning how to speak Italian, which is where he's from. So cute things like that, going to Italy. One of my mum's favourite quotes growing up was, never say no to a party. And she still says it. But my mum was the queen of throwing dinner parties. She throws really good parties. She'd have, you know, 80 people in our backyard and she'd cater for it. And she still is the same. Like she still will say, you know, if there's a party, you need to go there. She thinks it's one of like the best parts of life is like celebrating others. And she was always really great when I was growing up about throwing other people's parties at our house also. So if a friend wasn't allowed an 18th birthday party, I'd host it at my house and, you know, not tell their parents, but then have everyone at our house to celebrate it. My mum would make a cake and, you know, we'd have a dance party in the backyard. So it was definitely ingrained in me from a young age that parties were an integral part of life and like celebration. And my birthday party was always next level. There was always a theme, there was costumes, there was activities, I would always cry. It was a big deal. So it's definitely from my mum. But my mum also loved the disco. She talks a lot about the 70s and like disco culture, and that's also something that I'm also passionate about. Like I'm obsessed with like 70s revival stuff and John Travolta and Saturday Night Fever, and I got that all from my mum, 100%.
So you talk about your dad being quite responsible. Does he just sort of take the back seat when this is happening?
Well, apparently he used to go partying with my mum. Like I've heard a few stories. Like he would say to my mum something like, let's go out on the weekend. We'll go somewhere where you can wear your brown dress, which was apparently this one dress she had, which was like her party dress. And then they'd go to the disco. But yeah, mum's definitely like the one who organizes the parties, but dad's there. Like he enjoys it, but he's, you know, like a more reserved Italian man. My mum's the loud one.
Hey, my name is Kate and you're listening to This Australian Life. Here's more from Dulcie.
So like I was hosting them at my house, but yeah, my mum let me do it and she would cater and her food was really good. And everyone always talked about, you know, Adele Moletta's mum's food was something that we talked about a lot. But yeah, I was throwing parties, you know, since I remember like being like 8 or 10 years old, like having really elaborate birthday parties. But yeah, when I was in high school, my house became the hosting space for other people's parties as well. But I never thought I would be running parties or events. Like I was good at it, but it didn't feel like that was a job. I ended up studying filmmaking and I thought I was going to be a documentary filmmaker. And I did work in film for a while. And then I was a high school teacher. So there's been definitely other roads that I've traveled, but I have always come back to events. And I definitely think it's the happiest when I'm on stage seeing 500 people like living a beautiful life. So probably will do it for a long time. But yeah, it's funny when you look back that it's something you do as a kid is something that you end up doing as an adult. Oh, I did actually also make my brothers play schools where I was the teacher and I used to make them homework. I used to mark their maths work. So that is definitely something I followed through on as well. But I was into like a lot of different things. I played the piano. I was into painting, a lot of arty stuff. I watched a lot of film, a lot of documentary film. Yeah, but a lot to do with the arts. I was in acting school from about 8 years old. So I remember doing musical theatre outside of school and having 2 weeks off school to be in a production. And the arts were definitely ingrained in us as a family. That's where, you know, that's what we'd do as a family. We'd go see like a community production of something or go to the movies. Or I remember my parents taking me to like music festivals. And yeah, it was a big part of growing up.
I'm surprised your parents were more into the fact that you were queer considering like the arts are all queer people.
Yeah. They've definitely come a long way now. And now they're amazing. They're so on board. They're always asking when I'm introducing a new friend to them or what are their pronouns? What's their preferred name? Yeah. I think it's just a shock for some parents. And it just takes a little bit of adjusting. And they did talk about how it's like adjusting the life that they thought you were going to lead. And they talked a lot about, we thought you were going to marry a man and get married young and have a white picket fence house. And like all these things that they seem to associate with straightness, which, you know, if that's the life you choose to lead, you know, you can, you know, have a white picket fence and wear a dress still and all those things, even if you are queer. But it's like their idea of, you know, what it means to be queer is sometimes not completely accurate.
Talking a little bit about your mom, you said that she would throw parties for your friends even if their parents didn't know.
It's a bit naughty, isn't it, saying it out loud? It was a bit naughty.
Do you feel like you have that aspect, that sort of rebellion maybe in yourself as well?
Yeah, I definitely have always been someone that if I didn't think there was a good reason for not doing something, I would still do it. And I did that a lot throughout high school. I was definitely not someone who followed the rules. But I remember having conversations with my teachers when I'd be, you know, getting in trouble for something and they'd be like, we're going to tell your parents. And I'm like, yeah, good, tell my parents because, you know, my parents and I will have a conversation about it and I'll explain the reason behind why I did this thing. So it was definitely, yeah, instilled in me that, you know, you critically think about stuff. And so if I don't agree with something, I still won't do it. And I fight for what I think is important. And that has been a big part of Unicorns is that I didn't feel like the spaces that I was seeing were accessible enough or safe enough or prioritizing the people I thought needed prioritizing. So I go out and I do it myself. Or when I wanted a queer fitness thing to exist, because, you know, a lot of my friends were talking about gyms not necessarily being a safe space for them, you know, I go out and create it. Or there was no dating events where you could be multi-gendered attracted or not have to, you know, be a binary gender identity. So I go and create it. So I do feel like my rebellion is kind of more like if something's not there, I'll do it. I don't need to follow the rules or apply for a job. I'll create it.
So talking a little bit about your timeline, when was it that you came out again? How old were you?
Like maybe 24, I think. Yeah, something like that.
Was there like a moment where you're like, oh yeah, I am queer, or is it just something you
definitely
always sort of knew?
Yeah, no, I was going to Mardi Gras. I was doing all these queer things, but I definitely didn't know I was queer until I was at a party one night. And I was just dancing on the dance floor and then I met this girl and I was just like, oh, yes. And I remember it was like day to night, like the next day I was just like, oh, the world just makes sense. Everything just makes more sense. Like, it makes sense that all my friends are queer and that I want to be in these spaces. And I remember feeling like I want to be friends with queer people. And I'd thought that for such a long time. But yeah, it's funny how sometimes you're the last one to know. Like, I remember telling my friends and they were like, of course you are. And I was like, what? How did everyone know about me? Yeah, but I see it happen all the time. A lot of people come to Unicorns saying, oh, I'm not necessarily queer. I'm just supporting my friends. And a couple of years later, they'll be like, oh, I am queer. But, you know, we all have our own process and of coming to an understanding about who we are and our identity. I got a job in Manly in film location scouting, so going around to expensive houses and taking photos and then saying to, you know, a TV commercial, here's where you could shoot your advert in this white kitchen. That was my job, but I only lasted about 12 months because I just didn't feel like I fit in the industry. There were hardly any women and there were hardly any young women, and it was hard. I actually found it really challenging to be on set, and I often felt like I wasn't treated that well. But at the same time, I was being contacted by friends who had fashion labels, and they were like, you're really organized. Could you organize this photo shoot or this casting or this did like runway stuff? And so I just ended up doing that, but I was like, oh, I actually love this so much more. And like, I'm being treated well and I feel like I'm good at it. And so I was kind of freelancing doing events. And then an unpaid internship came up with a place called Century Venues, and they were putting on the first Sydney Fringe Festival. And I love fringe arts. Like, I love really underground, new art, weird, kind of wacky, interesting stuff like performance art. And it was a really long process, and there were 3 rounds of interviews to get this unpaid internship, which sounds ridiculous, but I really wanted to work on the first Fringe in Sydney. And I got it working underneath the director, the creative director of the festival. So I worked for 6 months unpaid to put on the first Fringe Festival, and it was just a bunch of unpaid interns and then this director. And yeah, it was really magical, and it was really like an important moment, and it gave me the confidence to then go, I'm going to try and work in these spaces and create events. And I was exposed to a lot of really interesting performance art parties, which helped to inspire the work that Unicorns, well, inspire, yeah, what Unicorns look like. Yeah, but it wasn't a journey I was like, thought I was going to be taking. I thought I'd go to Sydney and I'd make documentaries and make social change in that way.
What's a performance art party?
There was this amazing party that came out of the Fringe called the Mystery Bus, where this bus would pick you up from a petrol station in Newtown and you wouldn't know where you were going to go, and it'd take you to a warehouse and you'd step into the space and there'd just be characters performing everywhere. So there'd be like someone dressed as a cupcake coming out of one of those ball pits, and then there'd be people like feeding you, and then there'd be a pianist playing a song while this black and white movie plays, and like all this amazing art happening within a space that you kind of wandered through. And that was, I remember going to that party and being like, oh, this is life changing. Like, I don't know why, but I just loved it. And I loved being, yeah, surrounded by really interesting, different art that was really inspiring and colorful and quirky. But that's probably the best performance art party I've been to. So it's kind of like a party, but there's lots of people performing around you, and often it's interactive.
I feel like people must have a lot of perceptions of you that might not be true. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think that is probably true. I think people probably think I party a lot, but when you're running the party, you can't party. You know, you're the responsible one, you know, who's there at 4 a.m, sweeping up after everyone's gone and following the run sheet and getting the artists on stage and talking to the AV and communicating with security. Like, you're everywhere. So it's not about partying per se. I don't know what other misconceptions people might have about me, but people are usually surprised that I was a high school teacher for such a long time. They suppose they don't see that side of me when you see me as the person creating these parties or up on stage. But yeah, maybe people wouldn't see me as the person that's like really passionate about education and worked in the school system for a long time, or, you know, has a background in playing the piano and, you know, making documentaries and doing like cute but maybe dorky theater. But yeah, I think people probably just think I'm a raver. But I'm not sure though.
I was going to say, do you go out every night? Are you like kind of...
Oh, not at all. Like, I live alone with my cat and I love nothing more than going home and hanging out with my cat. But I work part-time for an organization called Rainbow Network, putting together educational events to help youth workers and teachers better support LGBTQI young people. So I work a day job and, you know, go to my office at La Trobe Uni in the Gender and Sexuality Research Center and create educational stuff, and then I'll go present a workshop on how to support queer young people. So don't really have the time to be a party animal, but obviously I do love parties because I'm really passionate about like good music. I love techno, I love electronic music. I grew up going to a lot of those kind of events, but you couldn't party every night and then work the amount of hours I work.
When you must have to socialize a lot. Are there ever times where you're just like, man, I really don't want to do this event. Like, what do I do?
Yeah. Like I was recently involved in a court case, which was really draining, and I was facing some online hate, which was really hard. And around that time, I have to admit, it was really difficult to get on stage and be like, yay for being queer, when I was being attacked daily for my queerness. Yeah, it can be really difficult. But, you know, deep down, I still know it's amazing to be queer and like I'm always being authentic in what I'm talking about. But yeah, it can be exhausting doing, yeah, this kind of work as well. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life. So I guess the court case that you've brought up, just to detail a little bit about the facts of it.
It's more about like that I was running events for queer adults and queer young people, but some stuff was said about me online that was completely untrue, and it just kind of escalated. It got shared a lot of times, and media started writing about it. So, but yeah, there was defamation, and then I decided to take legal action, and that's like a really long process. So going through that took probably about 2 years in total, which is exhausting for anyone who has been through something like that, knows like how draining and demanding it is. But in the end, I won and my name was cleared, and that was really good. But I think I was targeted because like the work I was doing with Unicorns was getting more attention, and then I was also working for a queer youth org, which is really successful and is one of the largest queer youth orgs in Australia. So I think I was doing a lot of good work, and sometimes when you're doing a lot of good work, you're also going to be the target of hate, unfortunately. But yeah, it ended about 3 months ago, so I'm really happy to be able to put it behind me. But it was a really important fight, and it was a really big win for the community because, I don't know, I'd never seen a defamation case like where an LGBTQIA person has won like that. And the fact that it was quite public, I think, is really powerful because it tells other people who are in a similar position, like if you are being defamed as a queer person in Australia, there is something you can do about it, and there are people that can support you. My barristers worked no win, no fee for me because they believe so much in what was happening to me, and they saw what happened to me and actually reached out to me saying, can we please represent you? And I wouldn't have even understood before that I could take legal action. So I think it's as hard as it was, I'm really proud that it happened and that I did take action and I didn't just try and hide and disappear and hope it would go away, because I feel like it's now set a precedent for, you know, other people who might be facing that stuff. Because as queer people, we do, you know, we can face a lot of hate, particularly online, where people think they can get away with it.
Moving forward, you do a lot with queer youth. You do a lot with these unicorn events. Do you ever do things that just have nothing to do with being queer?
That's so funny you say that, because that's one of the goals that my therapist has given me, is about working out ways to step back from my work so I don't burn out. Around the time when the whole defamation started, I was working across numerous queer orgs. I was working like day and night and then running events. So it was probably too much. But yeah, that's been my focus for the last 3 months, is like finding other avenues of my life that, I'm excited by, that are outside of my work, so that I can have longevity in the industry and not burn out. I just got myself a new electric piano. I hadn't played in over 10 years, so I got that on the weekend, so that's really nice. And then just like spending more time with my friends and doing nice things like that, and going to watch performance art again just for the joy of it, not because I'm like looking for a new artist, but I really love watching circus, and I love burlesque and comedy and connecting with that stuff. I've also been attending the School of Life for emotional intelligence development. They do interesting workshops. The last one I went to was How to Find Love, which was really fascinating, but kind of like pop psych vibes. So like learning about the psychology of humans and connection and stuff.
You sound like someone who clearly works very hard. Like, are you just walking around, like you said, looking for things? Like, you ever just like, whoa, like just turn it off?
Oh, I wish. Yeah. I am probably a little bit obsessive about the work that I do. I'm so passionate about it, which I suppose is a good thing and maybe not a good thing. Like, it means I've produced a lot of cool stuff and stuff that's been really powerful and important for community. But, yeah, I think finding balance is really important because, I want to still be doing this in, like, 10, 20 years. Like, I want to open a unicorn's venue as my next goal, which is going to be a huge, big project. And so, yeah, I want to be able to have sustainability so I can do those bigger projects. But finding balance, I think, can be really hard, but is also really important. And it was hard to find balance when I was working across so many queer orgs like Minus 18 and Switchboard and Joy when marriage equality was happening. So it didn't feel like it felt like we needed to ramp up. We needed to do more work. We couldn't take a step back. But yeah, this is one of my goals right now. Try and find more balance in life, do more fun things. I'm going to the theatre tonight. Good work, Delzy. Something fun.
When you talk about yourself and how hardworking you are, like, do you have any tips or like, because I imagine lots of people, myself included, would want to channel that. Is it just the way you are, or is there something that you do, like if you're losing motivation, that helps you?
Yeah, I think finding something that you're really passionate about means that it just doesn't feel like work. Like, sometimes my mum will call and be like, how many hours have you worked this week? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I wouldn't know and I wouldn't count, because a lot of it doesn't feel like work, particularly the unicorn stuff. Like, I love it so much that I don't mind when I'm working or what I'm doing. I don't know, because I love it. But yeah, finding something you're passionate about, I think, is definitely the driving factor. But I do have a lot of like cute rituals I do to like I suppose help stay focused. Like, I have a morning ritual where I exercise and then meditate, and then write down what I need to do for the day so that I can like clearly get through stuff. And I do like a reflection at the end of the night where I talk about like what I was really happy about, what I was grateful for, and then plan the next day. So I do have things that kind of keep me like on track, and I'm so goal orientated. So I'm always writing down like my goals for like the month and the year. And like, if I say I'm going to do something, I'm just someone that will complete it. Like, last year I was like, I'm going to create a festival. And in February, I, probably not the smartest move, but created a 10-hour festival on my own. Like, if I say I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. But I don't know, maybe that's just a personality thing.
Have you ever not done anything that you said you would?
I've been talking about the venue for a while and I haven't done it yet. But pretty much if I say I'm going to do something, I really am going to do it. But I do think about things a lot. So probably before I say it out loud, I've thought about it for a good amount of time.
So you were recently nominated, right, for this, do you want to say it?
LGBTI Person of the Year.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah, I was stoked, and it has been such a big year, such a wild year. You know, we're standing up for defamation against queer people, to running my first festival, to, you know, I've worked across so many different queer orgs, plus creating unicorns. Yeah, I felt really nice. Like, definitely had a bit of imposter syndrome when I was at the awards. What am I doing here? But no, it was really special. Really grateful for the people that nominated me, and it was just nice to be there.
Do you get recognized a lot?
Yeah, I do now, particularly after the court case, and like BuzzFeed put out a few articles and my face was on it. So I think that helped, but also probably doing unicorns for a while. But yeah, I get a little bit of the, are you Delzy from Unicorns? Which is always lovely. And I love hearing people's stories about their experience at Unicorns and how they found out about it and what it meant to them. And, yeah, it's beautiful. Like, I love all that. And I recently did a talk at something called Fuck Up Nights, which is a non-queer event where you go and you talk about a business fuck up. And so it was really interesting because it was, I don't often do a talk in a non-queer space. So I was connecting with a whole different audience, and it's quite a large audience. So now I've had people coming up from like the corporate business world coming up to me being like, I saw your talk, and wanting to connect in that way. And they've had people outside queer world be like, oh, you're Delzy who did that fuck up and talked about it on stage. So, yeah, but it's lovely. And yeah, I love meeting new people. So I feel like that's a nice thing that comes with the work that I've done.
So you see it as a benefit, because I imagine for some people it might be intimidating to have people coming up to you and maybe you just want to get your coffee or...
There were definitely points in the court case where I just felt like I can't talk about this anymore. And like my mental health was definitely deteriorating. So when people wanted to know where I was at, and like it's all this like, you know, there's a nice intention behind it. They're curious and they probably want to be supportive, but it was like, that was hard. I was like, yeah, it's hard to escape that. And yeah, it was a really hard time for me. Yeah. And when I was continuing to be attacked online and then people wanting to talk about when I was like, I'm struggling. But yeah, I'm in a different headspace now. So if people want to talk about that or about Unicorns, I'm like here for it. But yeah, definitely during the court case, I was like, just wanted to like run away. So yeah, it was harder.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Everyone keep being queer and sparkly and enjoying your life. Dye your hair pink if you like it. Pink pride.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Joy. Thanks for tuning into This Australian Life. Today, we're speaking with Bruce, who shares a little bit about his life as a counselor in an outpatient program for a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. Bruce also shares with us what it was like being one of the first people to be diagnosed with HIV in Queensland. Thanks for listening.
That's correct. Yeah, I work at a rehab and I look after the outpatients and aftercare, people who've been through the residential program, counselling, coaching. I've been working professionally there for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I did quite a bit of volunteer work as I went on my own journey in recovery. So over the last 15 years, but in the last 5 years, that's been my vocation. I made a decision to do it professionally. It was kind of pushed onto me, I think. My old job reached an end of a contract, and what was on offer wasn't stimulating me. I was in the security industry and I was just getting really bored, and I thought, I know what I really enjoy doing, and that's supporting people in recovery from addiction. So I went and enrolled in university to get new qualifications, but I pretty quickly got a phone call asking me if I wanted to work at a rehab, and I took that up, which was great to be able to do my tertiary studies while I was working in the field. And so the rehab's up in the country and I live in the city, so I'd have to take a 2-hour drive, which was nice to get out of the city, but, you know, it meant having to stay overnight up there. And so largely I would do a shift, what's called a support worker, which is making sure everyone's there, driving them in the bus to go to meetings, etc., and presenting some groups. You know, there's a lot of groups there, groups on processing issues, but there's also groups on growth, you know, like nutrition for, you know, once you get out of rehab, how are you going to look after yourself? Yoga, meditation. So as a support worker, I did quite a few different tasks. And then eventually I was asked if I'd like to work in the clinic in St Kilda as the outpatient and aftercare coordinator, and got my degree in counselling and coaching. And so I basically work one-on-one except with some small groups now.
Hey, my name's Kate, and this is This Australian Life.
The feeling when I got there was, this is $1 million view. And people would fly in from anywhere in the world to spend time here if it was a health retreat. But no, rehab's not a picnic. I mean, there's some goodness there, you know, the yoga and nutrition classes, yeah, they're great. But there's a lot of work to be done. When you put down the drugs and alcohol, the underlying issues are no longer medicated, and people have to work through that. There's a lot of tears. You know, not everyone makes it through what they've signed up for. Some people leave. So I can't pretend that, you know, it's a sweet deal. And as a private rehab, people pay, you know, significant fee to be there. Thankfully, we have some in Victoria that are public, and also some in the country that are public. But there's a lot of hard work to be done, in especially in early recovery, yeah. So with a private rehab, you're paying fees to be there, and they're usually significant. They're usually thousands of dollars per week. And very few rehabs have any kind of health insurance rebate. We do. We have a private hospital accreditation. But most don't. Public rehabs are funded through government, through health programs, and they will usually ask for a contribution from people's welfare payment, etc. So you have to apply, go on a waiting list. There's a significant ideological difference, I think. So with public funding, it needs to be in line with government policy, and government policy is pretty much around harm minimisation, which is great. Many of the private rehabs, particularly in Australia and Victoria, operate on the Minnesota model, which is an abstinence-based model. So there's an ideological difference between that, and the governments will very rarely, I don't think they're allowed to really fund that model, although the Victorian government, I'm aware they've put some funds into an outpatient program for people with methamphetamine addiction. And it's going to be abstinence-based, and they'll be referring people on to 12-step recovery. So that's great to see that they're recognising, because the academic research shows us that abstinence-based 12-step recovery works as well as any other modality. In harm minimisation, you're not requiring people to embrace abstinence unless that was what they wanted to do. So it can be, so like needle exchanges are a form of harm minimisation. And, you know, Australia did such a great job with that in the 80s. Thankfully, we had a government in Canberra that recognised the HIV epidemic could be assisted to be contained if people had access to condoms and syringes. So that's harm minimisation. Teaching people how to drink manageably or use safely. Pill testing, you know, that would be an aspect of harm minimisation. Mm-hmm. So it's accepting that people do these behaviours, people use drugs and other addictive behaviours, gambling, etc. And what they need is support to do them in a way that they won't hurt themselves.
Do you know the success rate of the inpatient program?
I know that ours currently is... And I'm not naming where I work, as you can hear,
yeah.
But I know ours is pretty high at the moment. It's the number of people that are getting 12 months up is up over 70%, as far as I'm aware, from the last survey we did. If you're making inquiries with a facility, that's definitely a question you should ask.
Mm-hmm. And how do they find out these statistics? They just call people up?
Yeah, we keep in touch with people who've been through the program.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Often, many of them take their place in that community program in 12-step, and many of them have become friends. So there's a dual role when you work under that model, because the workers are also in recovery themselves. So you often end up meeting your clients and patients out in the community as they go forward, which is really wonderful when you see someone. You know, I meet people years later, and I love bumping into people that welcomed me when I was first asking for help. And some of them are now like, you know, 35 years clean and sober, which seems extraordinary. But, you know, there have only been days when I've thought, I'm not going to that meeting today because I know the rehab I work at is going there. and I've got something that I need to share, you know, with other people and get support, and it's probably not appropriate for residents newly in recovery to hear me share that. But I don't mind most of the time, you know, I don't mind sharing what's going on for me. And you know, when I see someone who's doing well, well, no, I wouldn't want to deprive myself of that. So yeah, I have to be aware of ethics. I have to be, I don't approach someone in public if I know them from work. If they approach me, that's okay, but I won't approach them if I see them out in the community. Well, and I look back, so many, interactions with individuals, I would think, you know, if I could do that again, I'd do it differently. Absolutely, yeah. It's not easy to know how to support someone sometimes. Do you stay with the doctrine? Do you put aside the boundaries? You know, some programs, you know, an abstinence-based program where people are paying to go to rehab, sometimes people might come back from weekend leave and they've relapsed, etc. And relapse can be contagious if it's not contained. So you might have to ask them to leave for a few days and go home and work out whether they want to be there or not. You know, you can, if they don't come back, you can wonder, well, was that the right thing to do or not? But somewhere along the line, you have to follow best practice. You know, you can't be all things to all people.
I guess we didn't talk about this on air, but at one point you were diagnosed with HIV. Mm. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you realized that was the case?
Oh, well, yeah, I can,
a very
yeah.
good segue, sorry.
Well, no, look, it's such a big part of my life. Yeah. Mm. I was diagnosed in 1985. I was living in Queensland and my partner was a GP. And I took the test to set a good example for his patients, really, because he had a cohort of gay men as patients, and there was a lot of fear. You know, we'd heard about this, initially it was called GRID, because, you know, I used to read the medical magazines, and Queensland was a pretty oppressive state with a very conservative government. But yeah, I thought, look, I'll have the test. And when it came back positive, I was quite surprised. But I wasn't, it's telling now that I wasn't actually devastated. And my partner said to me, are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. He said, oh, I thought you'd be absolutely freaking out. And I, even then I said, no, actually, I sense that I'm going to be all right. And he told me I was in denial, and he said, you know, then he tested positive, and he said, look, within 2 years, one of us will be dead, and within 5 years, we'll both be dead. Well, he passed away 5 years later. But I'm still here, you know, it's been a tremendous journey. Yeah, I think I mentioned to you earlier substance abuse and other issues like domestic violence were just starting to get some currency in the LGBTI community, or what we call back then the gay community, or maybe the gay and lesbian community, and the free press that had risen up. So these issues, substance abuse, domestic violence, were getting some currency, and then HIV/AIDS came along, and it just completely took all the attention, all the resources, all the energy. It was such an emergency. You know, I mean, we were becoming aware of partner violence in lesbian relationships and in gay men's relationships, and suddenly no one had the time or the energy or the resources to talk about that. My HIV journey was an interesting one because I didn't get ill, you know, and I was labelled a long-term asymptomatic survivor, and I didn't need medication. And then eventually when the meds became so good that you could become have a viral load that was undetectable, and then they worked out that you couldn't transmit, I decided I would do that. I would take medication at that level. But, you know, that statistically is exceptional, and I was very, very fortunate the journey I had through HIV/AIDS, and it's not over.
Describe a little bit what your day-to-day is like as you work with patients who they've been to the residential community, right? Mm-hmm. And then now they're onto you.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we do use the term patients now because we have accreditation as a private hospital for detoxing. So they are actually patients. And once they've done their 90 days, or some people do 30 days, 60, but the full program is 90, then they come to aftercare. So I hold a small group. I facilitate a small group at St Kilda 3 times a week. And they attend that group. So they're checking in about how they're dealing with living in recovery now that they're back out in the community. They've been in an institution with regulations, and coming back out into the community is a real challenge. And by the time they've finished aftercare, the idea is that they'll be able to drive, you know, drive their own recovery going forward. So it's a group with some group counselling, some group processing, some psychoeducational material. We continue to do urine testing. Urine testing is correlated with good outcomes, so continue doing urine testing. And then when they finish their aftercare, which can be up to 6 weeks, many people choose to pay for more or to continue on with counselling or coaching, continue their therapeutic engagement. So I have patients who've been seeing me individually for years and years, and many of them have not relapsed in that time, but the therapeutic relationship is valuable to them. And then, you know, there are many who struggle and have relapses or have. It's important if someone slips that we do what we can that slip doesn't become a slide, and that a relapse becomes a teachable moment. So staying engaged therapeutically is really recommended. Mm-hmm. Some people, you know, if they relapse, will come back straight away. Some will come back to the same facility. Some will try a different facility. And I have heard anecdotally that the average number of attempts at rehab is 7 before people get substantial recovery, which is, you know, horrifying. It's only anecdotal as I share it with you. But yeah, I've personally met people who've done world tours of rehabs. And, you know, if their family or if they can afford that, well, you know, that's their journey. A lot of people can't afford it. But many people have to go back again. Or, you know, maybe they'll engage with me in an outpatient setting and not have to go back to the residential. So, like I said earlier, if there's a slip, it's very important that we do what we can so that slip doesn't become a slide. So if someone calls up and goes, look, you know, I went out with friends last night who I haven't seen for years, and they pulled out some coke, and, you know, I don't know, before I knew it, I'd done some coke, and now I don't know what to do. And because you get like a phenomena called the chase. When a person who hasn't used for a while uses, they crave more. But emotionally they don't feel too good. So if we get that call early enough, or their family might call us, they might not need to go back to rehab at all. It might be just, look, go to a meeting, you know, this, just strengthen your own recovery again. It's just a slip. Yeah, it's not the end of the world. But sometimes it, you know, it can actually be the end of their world. So,
Bruce, thank you so much. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we end here?
I think it's probably a bit of a slogan, but it's, you know, if you want to use drugs and alcohol, that's your business. If you need help, we can help you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you, Kate. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. But that's all the time we have for today. Please tune in next week as we hear from Ellen and her journey to becoming an actor, as well as much, much more. Thank you, and have a happy new year. Feel free to send us a message at thisaustralianlife@joy.org.au. See you next week.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.